This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com.
And this is James Evan Pilato of MediaMonarchy.com. And we both welcome you back to another important episode of The New World next week. And we're going to begin this week with, I think, a good continuation of our third story on the previous episode of The New World next week about all the dairy farms closed. That one really generated a lot of comments on YouTube and also on Facebook.com/MediaMonarchy. So perhaps in a way to kind of continue this discussion, and I think, James, it really shows what people are most concerned about and what is kind of shaken out. But we get this story from Democracy Now! Food Bubble, how Wall Street starves millions and gets away with it, while Goldman Sachs agreed to pay a $550 million fee to resolve a civil fraud lawsuit filed by the SEC, which they made back in one day. Goldman has not been held accountable for many of its other questionable investment practices. A new article in Harper's Magazine examines the role that Goldman, and of course others, played in the food crisis of 2008 when the ranks of the world's hungry increased by 250 million. James, I'm going to throw this back to you, but what this involves is basically a wheat price-fixing conspiracy. Am I right?
Well, yeah, a price fixing of sorts. At any rate, boosting up the demand artificially in order to increase the price. And really, there's no extra demand for wheat. It's just that there's more demand for these types of fictitious investments that are created by the vampire squid Goldman Sachs and then copied by others. And yeah, it becomes multi-billion dollar business. And meanwhile, the price of actual wheat just keeps going up and up and up. And people starve as a result. And it's an absolutely incredible process that people really need to go into this video and the article to learn more about. But suffice it to say, it's another engineered problem where the solution, as we've already seen being proposed by United Nations Population Fund and others, is that we of course need to reduce the population to ease the demand on these types of things, and we have to introduce wealth transfers, which is just another way of saying global government, and all these sorts of pre-engineered solutions, which are the inevitable result of these pre-engineered problems. So once again, it's goes back to Goldman Sachs and the wizards of Wall Street who are behind all of these manipulations.
Mm-hmm. And again, you know, that's the common thread that we see, I think, regardless of what story we're talking about, is that the same folks that engineer the problem to get the reaction out of us are the same folks who will then pose as our saviors to hand us this ready-made solution that, of course, only really benefits them. We do have this full article linked up, and we will have some of the supplemental contextual information linked up for you in the show notes of this episode. And again, that's something that we try and do for you here is, again, collect the information, give you the documentation of what we're talking about and what we're sourcing, and hand it to you, because that's the folks out there. It's up to all of us and everyone out there to spread this information all around. Now, James, I think we tried to put together a show that would have a little bit of flow to it and stories that really do connect. We're going to hop down to the Bay Area now for story number two, and we're going to get this from San Francisco Weekly. Oakland marijuana law passes, pot factories coming to the Bay Area. The Oakland City Council approved an ordinance allowing industrial-scale marijuana-growing operations to set up shop in town, supplying the city's medical pot dispensaries. The measure is expected by some estimates to generate up to $2 million in tax revenue for the cash-strapped city. Of course, this being the city that now won't respond to the majority of things that folks would call up 911 for. This would also be the city that we just saw riots in after the latest episode of police brutality. Tying all that in, it all connects. But not everyone is celebrating this new marijuana law. One council member voted against it, two abstained. But in this curious dynamic that's been playing out in Oakland since they first started to talk about this, small-time growers strongly opposed the measure, arguing it would drive down the price of weed and dilute its quality. Now, the SF Weekly kind of snarkily notes, don't get too excited, folks, for driving down the price of weed. The permits for these large-scale operations won't be issued until January 2011. Now, the funny thing is they're saying small-time grow operations against these criticisms, that small-time growers have led to public safety hazards, fires, burglaries, home invasions, health risks, and related response costs to the city. James, another interesting tie-in to this, and some of my friends at groundzeromedia.org and tracytwyman.com, their take on this story in a way is that they're going to give us weed but take everything else away, and we're essentially going to see tobacco corporations pack it with chemicals, make it much worse. It'll burn fast. You can only get it, say, in liquor stores or pharmacies, and that's how it'll start. They're going to get a higher cut of the profit, and it's that same story, again, that we've seen time and time again, that our misleaders and the elites and the multi-generational serial killers, if you will, gobble up the real and sell us back basically a fake. They take the real resources and sell us back the facsimile. So on the one hand, we do kind of rejoice in seeing, you know, something that essentially grows naturally here on Earth, that making it against the law, one, is unnatural. But putting all these stipulations on it, saying it needs to be licensed and regulated, makes it look like it is this dangerous devil weed and not something that by just natural law would say we have the right to use it. It grows here.
James. Right, right, exactly. So you hit the nail on the head there. I think this is just another example of government stepping in to give the public something, but really just putting all of their stipulations and things on top of it so they can control it outright. And we've seen examples of that all over the place, such as the FCC stepping in to give us net neutrality, which is a good thing, but then they go, oh, by the way, because we have control to give net neutrality, we also have control to, say, give Obama a kill switch over the internet. So they always let us swallow these things, these poison pills that taste good and sugar-coated on the outside, but there's always things inside that will make them unpalatable, and this is another example. So it's just more government encroachment rather than the opposite, which is liberation, which is what we're looking for. Very interesting story, but moving right along to story number three.
And again, it's all connected. Now, this next story from connectmidmichigan.com is posted up on mediamonarchy.com, surrounded by a whole lot of other new financial world order related stories. And of course, this all tying and being connected into Obama's financial overhaul bill, this Dodd-Frank financial regulation disaster. But without getting into any of that, let's kind of stick on the positive. And I think, again, these stories kind of show an arc. Competing currencies being accepted in Michigan. New types of money popping up across mid-Michigan, and supporters say it's not counterfeit, but rather a competing currency. Right now, you can buy a meal, visit a chiropractor without using actual U.S. legal tender. They sound like real money and look like real money, but you can't take them to the bank because they're not made at a government mint. They're made at private mints. I sell three or four every single day, and I get one or two back a week, says Dave Gilley, owner of a restaurant in this area. He says he accepts silver, gold, copper, other precious metals to pay for food. He said if he wanted to, he could accept marbles. Do people have to accept dollars or money? No, they don't. They can accept anything they want, or they can refuse to accept anything. And he's absolutely right. The U.S. Treasury Department says the Coinage Act of 1965 says, quote, private businesses are free to develop their own policies on whether or not to accept cash unless there's a state law which says otherwise. James, quickly, will throw out that, of course, Michigan is not the only place where this is going on. We can link up and you can check out competing currencies, alternative currencies, they're sometimes called, everything from the Calgary dollar to the Cascadia hour exchange, from right here in the Pacific Northwest, and you can learn more about that at CascadiaHourExchange.com. But I think this ends this episode on kind of an upswing arc.
Absolutely, exactly. I think people don't really understand how the pieces of paper in their pocket are really one of the primary instruments of their enslavement, so we have to create competing currencies to overcome that. And just on that note, this week my episode on my podcast is going to be about currencies and how they've been used as tools for liberation in the past, so stay tuned for that.
Excellent, excellent. See, it really is all connected. And I have to throw out quickly that, of course, the Bohemian Grove meeting kicks off this weekend in the California Redwoods. And again, it's all connected. James, thanks so much, man.
Thank you.